Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where you'll find broad topics, an unconventional dyad, and one shared goal, educating ourselves through challenging and engaging conversations. Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to having discussions that are real, raw, and unpolished. Thank you for joining us. Hello everyone, thank you for listening in to today's episode. Today we have two very special guests with us, Jessica Jensen and Paul Dietrich. Jessica and Paul are professional musicians, and Paul is a jazz composer. Today you'll hear a few different pieces, so right now you are hearing The Fool, played by Jess. At the end of the episode, you can hear Paul playing Perennial. Today on the podcast, we discuss a lot of different topics, but to highlight a few of them, we talk about music transcending language, and how music can really only have meaning when we, as audience members, are able to empathize with what it is that the composer wanted to share with us. We also discuss the importance of music education and cross-cultural music performances. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and as always, thank you for your continued support.
This episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast is sponsored by Anchor. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. First of all, Anchor is completely free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, and Anchor will distribute your podcast for you, so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and many more. It's everything you need to make a podcast all in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. As always, thank you so much for being with us for another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. We're glad that you're here and we'd love to hear from you. If you like what you're hearing and you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so at Patreon or at anchor.fm. You can also subscribe, rate, and review this show on Apple Podcasts. Thank you.
Jess and Paul, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I am really excited to get a chance to hear where you guys have been and what you've been doing.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, happy to be
here. Yeah. So I guess we can say that this is our first quintet on the podcast. We not only have you two, but we also have your dog. So I am really delighted to get a chance to have all five of us present in the podcast.
He has very deep thoughts about things, so.
Oh, I bet.
Like food.
Probably. Yes.
But, yeah.
So to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves, who you are, maybe share parts of your professional and personal identities that you think are important for our listeners to know about?
Okay, well, I guess Paul gave me the look, so that means I have to go first. So I'm Jessica Jensen, and I am a classical trumpet player. Currently, I live in Hortonville, Wisconsin. We recently moved here. We were in Madison for about 10 years. But yeah, I am mostly a classical trumpet player, performer, gig with several, you know, small orchestras in the region, do a lot of what they call chamber playing, which is like small group playing. So it'd be like me, maybe like a French horn and a trombone, and then we make music that way with a small group like that. And then solo stuff. I do a lot of teaching in the area to beginners through comeback players who are post-retirement age and are just, you know, they see that trumpet in the closet and they're like, oh, I'm going to pull it out and see what happens. So that's me.
Yeah. And I'm Paul Dietrich. I'm also a trumpet player. although I am more on the jazz music side of things. Although both of us kind of do all sorts of music, it's just, I guess you would say that I would specialize in jazz and she specializes in classical music. I also do a lot of playing in the area. I write music. I lead a couple of bands that haven't played in a long time because it's pandemic right now. But I also teach. So we're both set up to do remote teaching in our house for now. And that's kind of what we're doing currently.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Jess, you also went to school at Madison as well. Can you share a little bit about your journey into your doctoral program and what that was like?
Oh, sure. Actually, I just kind of stumbled into it. It wasn't really a graceful journey. So I don't know if the listeners know, but Carly and I went to undergrad together. We were roommates at Lawrence for like 2 years. So then after Lawrence, I was really thinking about maybe taking a gap year, you know, just working. And then a position at Madison in their graduate quintet opened up. So I took a lesson with the teacher at Madison, and it just kind of worked out that position would be a good fit. So then ended up not doing a gap year and going to Madison. And then when my time in my master's was about up, a spot in the faculty brass quintet opened up, and I was like, oh, I'll apply for it, see what happens. And then it worked out, so I was like, oh, I'll just stay in school for a few more years, get it done. So I played in the faculty quintet at UW-Madison then while I was working on my doctorate. So I guess my educational journey was just going with the flow.
Very cool. How did you both get interested in music? How did that start for each of you?
Oh, that's a good question. Do you want to?
Yeah, I think it's actually quite different for the two of us. We come from very different backgrounds. I grew up in a family of musicians. My dad just retired a little over a year ago. But he taught for almost 40 years as a collegiate music professor at Ripon College. And my mom is a pianist and organist. She still is teaching. I think she's down to one right now, but she's still teaching piano lessons out of my parents' house. And she did that all through my childhood. My older brother is not a professional musician, but he plays music. So I was just around it my whole life, and it sort of came easy to me. I grew up in a small town, which, you know, has drawbacks as far as the musical opportunities that can be made available for you, but it also means that when I was just like a little bit good at music as a young person, it seemed like I was a lot better than everybody else because I was in a small town, which, you know, gave me a little bit of confidence early on, which was quickly stamped out later, but it worked out early on. So, yeah, I grew up in a very musical family, and it just was sort of a natural progression for me. But you did not.
Yeah, we're a little bit different. So I did not come from a musical family. My parents actually own a small heavy duty truck repair shop, which is very, very different from music. But you know, they, a lot of people, when they're joking about music, they'll say like, oh, I'm tone deaf, I can't carry a tune. When in actuality, like, tone deafness isn't super common, but, I think my dad might be tone deaf. We did. I did this like little experiment growing up where like I got on a piano and I was like, okay, tell me which one is higher or lower. And I could literally be at like one end of the piano and then the other. And he's like, I couldn't tell you. So anyway, that's a little bit from my background. But, you know, even though my parents, you know, worked at a heavy duty truck repair shop, they really supported me in like literally anything I wanted to do. They would be there to support me. So they never deterred me from going along this path. But you know, back in fifth grade, picking up the instruments, I was a super, super shy child. Like, it was really bad. And, you know, I tried all the instruments. I tried all the woodwind instruments because, you know, that's what all the cool kids were doing. And then the person helping me pick an instrument is like, oh, you should try a brass. So I was like, okay, I'll try trumpet. And I picked it up, and it was like this this Harry Potter effect, you know, where like the light comes down and like the wind, you know, it just felt totally right. And being a very introverted child, being able to just pick up like the loudest instrument and make this like horrendous like blart was totally liberating. So I guess going along that path, I'm still a pretty reserved person in most social situations, but having, you know, this loud instrument to like let your voice come out has been really liberating. I'm very thankful for that outlet.
Yeah, I was going to say, for a shy child, the trumpet is an interesting choice, but that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I like that. Why the trumpet for you, Paul?
I don't have.
Dad didn't want another trombone in the family. Yeah,
my dad's a trombone player. So I grew up in a house that had a lot of brass music being played. When I was young, my first instrument was actually violin, which is pretty common for like real young children will often start on violin. And I started violin when I was like 3 years old, and I didn't like it very much. I switched over to piano. Played piano all through my childhood. So I played piano for several years. I mean, I didn't start band until sixth grade. So I played piano for a while, but I wanted to play. There's no piano in band, so I wanted to play in band. And I don't think I had a real good reason for choosing trumpet. I just thought it was cool. I remember thinking that trumpet and drums were the two coolest instruments, and I wanted to do one of the two. And I did end up playing drums a little bit later just for fun, but I chose trumpet and it worked out. So
nice.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, you have very different interests in music. What is it like being married and living together with very different musical interests and specialties?
Well, I think we're a lot more similar than like most couples. You know, the stereotype, like they're type A egomaniacs, which we are both very type B, so we get along pretty well, I think.
Yeah, well, I think even musically, we do kind of share more in common than you might think. I think a lot of the music that we like to listen to for fun is similar, and a lot of the music that we, you know, like the jazz music that I really listen to a lot, Jessica tends to like, and mm-hmm. the classical music that she likes. We have slightly different tastes in classical music, but we still like a lot of the same stuff. So we do kind of follow different paths in terms of what we perform and what we practice and things like that. But there's a lot of crossover, I think, in terms of our like musical taste.
Mm-hmm. And it's also nice being married to a trumpet player, because like if we see a trumpet we want on eBay or something, like usually the other is very supportive about adding more toys to our collection, which I don't think most couples are that fortunate.
And also, I mean, like practicing trumpet is loud and you have to do it for a lot of time every day, so I could see that like if one of us was not a trumpet player, we might not be all that happy about that all the time. But yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so did you meet in a musical context, or how did you two meet?
Freshman year back at Lawrence in the trumpet studio.
Yeah, we went to college together. Mm-hmm. And we played in the same music studio for a couple years before anything happened. So yeah, We knew each other for a while before we became romantically involved.
Paul, I'm really interested in your your interest in jazz. And I'm wondering if you can share a little bit about your interest in jazz, where you think that started, and really where you've gone with it. I mean, you've written a ton of music and it's amazing, and we'll certainly have our listeners listen to some of it, but can you share a little bit about your interest in jazz?
Yeah. Well, again, I mentioned that my dad was a professional musician. He would identify more as a jazz musician than anything else. His career covered a lot of different ground. But his initial interests in music were mainly as a jazz musician. And he was a member of a band. My parents actually also went to Lawrence. So there's a lot of Lawrence connections here on this podcast right now. But he was a member of a band that started at Lawrence back in like 1974 or 75, called Matrix, that ended up like, they were sort of a big deal, I guess. They recorded 5 albums in the late 70s and early 80s and toured around for like 5 years around the whole United States. And my dad was a member of that band from the very beginning to the very end. And that was like a jazz fusion band, which basically just means it's like a jazz band, except...
Where does that come from?
I don't know. I don't know why at first I was inspired to write my own music. I mean, I was writing like bad, like rock music in high school. So it goes back a long way when I just like felt like creating something. I think there have been times in my life, honestly, where like I started writing, I write music for large ensemble, not big band, which is like 18, 19 people in the band. And honestly, the reason I really started getting into that is because when I was in graduate school, I wanted to play music that I liked more. And I knew that our director was really open about playing student composition. So I was like, well, if I'm not that big a fan of a lot of the stuff that we're playing, and I would like to play music that I like better, maybe I should just write it and bring it in, which honestly, like, is really strange problem solving. If you think about it, like, I'm sure there were better things that I could have done, but that's kind of how I got into that. But other than that, I think it's just like, for me, the more I listen to music that I really like and the more I think about it, it makes me want to try to make it. And that's kind of where I get to that point where I just kind of want to see what happens. But,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you create something that you want to hear and you want to listen to.
Hopefully.
And Jess, you do not write your own music, but you also are very talented. And I am wondering if you can share a little bit about where your inspiration comes from and your talent and really your creativity with music.
I guess, you know, classical music, you don't really make up your own stuff. You don't improvise, you don't create in that sense. But you know, you get these pieces that other people have wrote, or even, you know, Paul has written some stuff for me too, which is a really cool experience. But you get this material that other people have written, and you know, you have to dig down and you have to think about, okay, what did the composer want to say? And how do you get that out through your instrument? But then if that was all that was behind it, you would only have one recording of like every piece, because you know, once you get to that goal, like, why record it anymore? But then what makes it so special is each performer has to figure out, okay, that's what the composer wants to say. Now, what do you want to say? Like, what part of yourself can you inject into it? And the cool thing that I think about classical music is that sometimes there's something very explicit you want to say, like something very concrete, something very obvious. But sometimes it's more subtle. It's just a feeling that you can't really put into words. And being able to get that out through your belt and just share that with people is really special. And another thing I really like is it can mean something totally different for like every person in the room. You know, you can come up, you're like, okay, I'm going to try to express this feeling, this thought, whatever. And you can put it through the bell and it can really touch somebody else, maybe in a completely different way. They can have a totally different connection to it, but the connection is equally as powerful. So I think that's where I derive my inspiration to perform and try to, you know, foster my creativity that way.
That process reminds me a lot of empathy. And not only are you trying to empathize, so to speak, with the composer, you're also trying to provide something for others to empathize with you. So it's this really interesting process where you are trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes, into the composer's shoes, and yet you're trying to
I remember this master class I went to when I was in grad school. This composer, Tony Plogue, he writes a ton of brass music. During his master class, you know, he said something along the lines of, you want to be a better performer, you want to be a better musician, go read a book. Learn how to empathize, put yourself in somebody else's shoes. I think that's totally integral to the whole process.
Wow, that's really powerful.
Yeah, it's almost you're the conduit from, you know, the composer to the audience. You're kind of the instrument, and I don't mean that literally, I mean it very much symbolically. You're the instrument from the composer to the audience or the people who are listening. Mm-hmm.
I love that. I'm wondering, you kind of touched on this a little bit, Jess, already, but I'm wondering what kind of role music plays in your in your lives, in your relationship with one another, and your relationship with other people.
Well, I think, especially for me, growing up in like a non-musical family, music has sort of shown me this community that I didn't know existed. So through music, you know, you play a lot of gigs, you meet a lot of people that I would have never, a lot of friends that I would have never have had the opportunity to have talked to before. So I guess, yeah, music has given me a sense of community that I wouldn't have known existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting to think about that too, because and I'm sure this happens in like other professions and stuff too, but for me it's like music is not a job. It's kind of just like my entire life. And I mean, like, I do things that are not musically related, but it seems very different for me from, like, you know, I've never worked like a full-time job, so to speak. But I've had other jobs where, like, you got to show up and you got to clock in or whatever. And then you finish doing whatever work you were doing. And then you go home and you don't think about it anymore. And music is not like that for me. And I know it's not like that for Jessica. It's the same thing. Like, you guys, I'm sure you're thinking about, like, psychology or whatever when you get home at night and stuff like that. It is always there. And, you know, we'll be doing music related things from 10 minutes after we get out of bed to 10 minutes before we go to bed, and it doesn't feel like work, but it's just kind of always there. I don't know.
For better or for worse. Yeah. It's always there.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A question that I have too. So both of you are really interested in education and providing, you know, education to people. I'm kind of wondering how you imagine making music more accessible to people. People who might not have the access to music, kind of, how do you imagine bringing music to the greater population, to people who might not have it otherwise?
That's a great question. Well, I know, like, in Madison, Paul was a part of some organizations that would play these, like, free sort of gigs, like the Dig Series in Madison. Mm-hmm. You know, they received these public grants where, like, they would play at libraries and things like that, where, like, anybody could go. So reaching out to provide opportunities there. In Madison, I was a part of, you know, some groups that would receive funding, and then we'd go out to, like, nursing homes and play for that community.
Elementary schools
to get, you know, students who maybe were like me, had no idea that this was something that anybody could do. So I think, yeah, just trying to do as much outreach to elementary schools.
Yeah, I think we're kind of thinking about it in a new way now, too, because now that we're up in Hortonville, Wisconsin, I mean, we're close to Appleton, but, like, in Madison, there's a lot of artists of all kinds. So even though you sometimes have to work to get music or art or literature or whatever to the people that are kind of sometimes underserved, it's easily accessible. And it's there for organizations to kind of make that connection. But it becomes harder, I think, when you get, you know, out a little further. And I think that's something that we've been thinking about here is, I mean, we don't really know what things are going to be like when the whole pandemic situation is over, and we have a lot to kind of, you know, we have to sort of do reconnaissance on our new home before we really know exactly what we're going to do. But we've had some conversations about, like, how to kind of apply some of the same lessons that we took from Madison, but also just that there's not quite as many professional musicians around here and things like that. And I don't think that means that it would be necessarily hard to try to start programs like that, or free concert series, or just concert series in general, things like that. But I don't know. We have to figure out what it's going to look like, but we're definitely thinking about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you also took a trip over the last few years to Cuba. Can you tell us a little bit about your
trip? That was fun. That was, so it feels like it was about 20 years ago, but that was January 2019 that we did that. And there's one of the great kind of art supporters in Madison. It's this man named Ricardo Gonzalez, who is not a musician himself, but for many years he was the owner of a bar called the Cardinal Bar in Madison. And they were very open to live music, very friendly to musicians. They had a whole bunch of all sorts of different kinds of music there. And Ricardo is from Cuba. He was born in Cuba, and he came to the United States, I believe, when he was in high school. I think he was like 16 or 17. And strangely enough, he actually ended up in Ripon, where I'm from, for a while, in the late 1960s. But he has been a big kind of bridge builder for just kind of cultural exchanges from Cuba to the United States. He made Madison is, I think, officially the sister city of this city in Cuba called Camaway, which is where Ricardo's from.
It's the third largest.
I think it's the third largest city
in Cuba.
There's an interesting story about it. It's inland, which is weird. And they told us that the story was that Camaway, the city, used to be on the coast, and they got raided by pirates so many times that they're just like, nope, we're not doing this anymore. So they just picked up the whole town and moved it like 60 miles and rebuilt. It's an interesting story. Wow. But yeah, so he has organized several of these trips where, and he was helped on this, our good friend Nick Moran, who is a bass player in Madison. and a very visible, very great proponent of jazz music and different. He's half Peruvian, so he plays a lot of Peruvian music too. And he and Ricardo kind of set up this trip where they took, there were like 10 or 12 of us, maybe like 30 other people, folks who just wanted to see Cuba that also went along on the trip. And it was a really interesting experience. It was great to be able to play some music with the local musicians there. Just to get to kind of see Cuban culture, which is really interesting. I guess neither of us has done a whole lot of traveling in the rest of Latin America, so we can't say for sure, but it's an interesting country. The people are super friendly, and like, I know we didn't get any weird looks really like the whole time we were there for being American. I don't think that most people really care about that. But also, like, you would see times where like people are like kind of talking a little bit quietly about something, like, maybe don't tell anybody I said that, and things like that.
I really loved how much music and dance was just a part of life. Like, it wasn't like a job or like set off in like this, you know, one part of your life. It was just everybody's life. Like, if you're a musician or not, like, everybody just like participated. And like dancing too is really,
there was a great story that we were visiting this art gallery. There's this man in Kemway who makes some art. We actually bought some of his art. It's on our walls right now. But he had a young woman working in his shop who actually spoke pretty fluent English, which is a little bit rare. I think that's one thing that's a little different in Cuba, is that there aren't very many trained English speakers. So we were having a conversation with her, and somebody who we were on the trip with just asked her kind of casually, "So do you dance?" And she said, her response was perfect. She goes, "Well, I am Cuban."
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah, I feel like a lot of times in the United States, we kind of miss, we don't have that, you know, we don't have music and dance and the arts embedded into our culture in some ways that maybe other countries do. I don't know about you all, but when I was growing up, one of the first things to go when we had budget cuts at school was the arts program, the music program. You know, they never really fully went away, but people cut down on them a lot. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the value of music in our culture, in society, in communities. Because I feel like, yeah, the knee-jerk reaction when there's like budget cuts or when we're looking at how to reorganize or rethink our educational system, like, the arts aren't front and center most of the time, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just gets back to, I mean, Carly, you were talking about empathy before, and I think that, I mean, it's just like, look around this country right now. I feel like there's maybe nothing more important than like learning to empathize with people. And I think the arts are the best way to do that. All arts of all kinds, like, I'm not saying it's just about music, but I sometimes see like people put things on Facebook or whatever that like are like arguments about how like the arts bring in a certain amount of money to the economy, or like art makes you better at math. And it's like, maybe those things are true. I mean, like, they are true, but also I think that's missing the point entirely. I think it's really sad that people feel like they need to justify art that way. And I wish that, like, in general, people would just like understand that it's important, and it's really sometimes like, it hurts to look around and see people be like, "Oh, well, we don't need that."
That's right. Totally it. And like, art, it, you know, in education, humanities and the arts, you're constantly learning about music and art from like every different culture. which in turn like makes you into like an informed like global citizen. So like when you get, you know, when you become of age to vote, you're not just thinking about how certain policies affect you. You're automatically thinking about like, you know, you put yourself in another person's shoes who maybe isn't as fortunate as you, and you know, really think about how these policies affect them. So I think, yeah, as Paul said, that's one of the most important things about having art in an educational system, is it just really gives people empathy, which we need right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very experiential too. Like, there's something about art that's really cool that I don't think you really get in a lot of other subjects in school. Like, I don't know, to me, I didn't experience math in the same way that I experienced, you know, like literature, for example. There's just something very different about that experiential piece when it comes to art. And I think it does really help with empathy and just connection in general to other human beings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something else that comes to mind is, even if you don't speak the same language, someone can listen to a song and both feel something from the song. It might be from their own perspective, of course, their own kind of cultural histories, their own interpersonal histories. They hear a song and people will start moving, they'll start dancing. They're connecting, though they're coming from different directions, different experiences. They're able to connect with that song, and it transcends language. It transcends like the spoken word.
That kind of brings me back to our Cuba discussion, actually. So part of the Artreach concerts we did like half American jazz music. And Paul, even we played some of Paul's tunes too, which was really cool. And then we did like half like traditional Cuban music. And, you know, people say music is a universal language, but the first few rehearsals we have, it was not a universal language. Like us, a lot of Latin music, a lot of Cuban music, there's a lot of off beats, right? There's a lot of these like what we feel are like really complex rhythms. So like us Americans were just like clomping all over the place. Just like we sounded so unnatural. And then when some of the Cuban musicians would play, what we felt were like really straight ahead, like, you know, quarter notes, eighth note, like easy for us rhythms, like they were having trouble with it. So it was just a kind of a fun experience. Like as the, you know, week progressed, like we started to speak the same language, but there was definitely like a moment where like, you know, we weren't totally. It was just kind of a fun musical experience.
Yeah. But I mean, I think like, just like to your point too about like transcending language and stuff. I mean, I think we just need to think about, I mean, the music that we listen to all the time, or like what it, like some of the most famous music in the history of the world, right? Like, I mean, none of us speak German, but we can, well, Jessica does, but we can still enjoy Beethoven's music. Or like none of us, like even if we don't speak the language, like we can still be moved by like the like drumming and singing that comes out of Ghana, for example, and things like that. And I mean, there's a long history going back even like to the 1800s of like these famous composers like feeling compelled to go learn music from, whether it's West Africa or whether it's like Indonesia, Pacific Islands and stuff like that, just trying to pick up this music from other cultures. And I don't know. I mean, in how many other walks of life do people like actively go out to search for that stuff and connect with it like immediately on a level that feels important to them? I don't know. It's cool.
Yeah. Definitely.
So I have a few more questions for you. I'm wondering, I don't know exactly how you want to answer this question, whether you want to do it together or if you want to have separate answers. It's really up to you. I'm curious about where you see music going. Where do you see, I mean, we're right in the middle of a pandemic. I'm sure things have changed drastically for so many musicians, and unfortunately we don't have enough time to talk about that here, but I'm just wondering where you see music heading. Where do you see music education heading? Just music in general.
Well, I mean, it's personally my hope. I don't know if I necessarily see it going this way, but it's my hope that after the pandemic, you know, people for the past, what, 6 months?
Nine months.
Everybody has been in front of screens, you know, only like digital music, only these like, you know, very electronic sources. It's my hope that once we are finally like able to get out in our communities again, that live music is going to have a boom. People are going to like really miss that interpersonal connection and just, you know, the spirit of the music that you can get through live performance. So it's my hope that after the pandemic, we're going to see a boom in live music. Because even pre-pandemic, there was a lot of live music performance venues weren't doing so great. You know, I think people just like, they're like, yay, we have Apple Music, we have all this other stuff. Why do we need to go out to live shows? And I think the pandemic has maybe placed a new importance on interpersonal connection and just being with people. So yeah, it is my hope that that industry will come back even stronger than before.
Yeah, I already miss concerts. Like, I've been thinking about concerts mm-hmm. for the last several weeks, just really missing them. And like, I miss the live, yeah, aspect of it and being around other people and mm-hmm. Finding joy together as like a community mm-hmm. in that music. I really
yeah, miss and that. I mean, it's interesting from the perspective of like, well, from my perspective, I guess, like, I mean, obviously for ourselves, I mean, part of our job is as performing musicians. So like from a financial perspective, it's been tough not being able to go to concerts, but I think like just as like damaging is just the lack of an opportunity. Like for us on our side of the band stand, you could say, there's something about it that feels like almost necessary. I don't know. I luckily towards the end of summer, I had the opportunity to actually play a couple of shows live out. I did one indoor concert that we did in a gigantic concert hall with nobody in there that they live streamed. So I got to play a little bit of music mm-hmm. towards the end of the summer. And those were the first time I played with any other live person other than once in a while when we would play something together, but it felt so relieving. That's the word that comes to mind. Like just being able to do that with other people again. It's something that, you know, for most musicians I know, like the 6 months that passed between the last gig I played, the last gig I remember playing before the shutdown was I played a gospel choir gig at the beginning of March. And the time that passed between then and the next time I played, which was in like early August, I think, it was the longest I'd ever gone without playing in front of an audience, like ever since I started playing music, I think. And I don't know, Jessica, you haven't played any live gigs since March.
Really much.
So for a lot of musicians, like for some musicians, we're lucky that we're able to keep teaching at a level that's sustaining us financially. I know I know musicians that don't really teach very much in the last 9 months of it. 8 months have been really difficult for them financially, and that's tragic. Mm-hmm. But for all the musicians I know, it's just like not being able to play with other people is really a painful part of this whole thing. And yeah, I mean, I hope that when the pandemic comes back or ends, I hope there is a comeback for live music, and maybe there will be, but I don't know, being a musician is sort of a tenuous job anyway. And I mean, like you mentioned Apple Music and Spotify and stuff, like if you're looking at like broad, big picture, future of the music industry, like we're going to have to figure something out about that because musicians just can't make money off of recording music anymore. And if that continues that way, I think the overall quality of music is just going to drop. I don't think there's going to be a shortage of people who want to play music, but I think like the recordings that you get aren't going to be as plentiful or as well recorded. There's going to be a lot more like kind of DIY stuff that will still be good, but just the quality isn't going to be there. It's a difficult industry. And there's a whole thing about like you mentioned like music education and stuff. There's a whole different conversation about kind of maybe I'm taking a step too far here, but like just the way that music is treated in institutions and the way it's taught in institutions is sometimes a little strange. And it's interesting that like a huge part of the economy of music now is tied to higher education. I would have to organize my thoughts on that before spouting off about it, but it's a conversation to be had for sure.
Maybe another episode, Paul, because I'm also really interested in higher ed, and I know we didn't get a chance to talk about that today, but it's certainly something that I think really needs to be talked about. And I know that you both and I have had conversations about higher ed and music and kind of the direction that it's heading. One last question for you guys, and I think this might come off of what we were just talking about. I'm wondering if, you know, over the last 9 months, you can reflect back and think about one lesson that you've learned that you really hope to carry with you in the future.
I think one thing I really hope that not just me, but like everybody gets out of this pandemic is just slow down. You know, pre-pandemic, I was so busy. Like there was no time to go for like an after dinner walk or like, it was like, I was playing so many gigs that maybe I didn't really find enjoyment out of, or like, I just felt a need to always say yes to everything. And I didn't have time to, you know, just be myself, you know, focus on what I really need to do. That was some of my students too. There's a few of my private students now who are actually, they've gotten a lot better at trumpet over the pandemic just because like they don't have all this extra pressure, all this extra noise. So I think, one thing I want to carry over after the pandemic is just slow down. You don't need to be that busy just to be busy to say that you're busy, because that makes you worthy or some weird thing like that. Slow down. I think that's my big one.
And I guess for me, like, it's, I definitely agree with what Jessica just said, but I also think I've just been doing a lot of thinking about like why we do what we do. And you know, I mean, the reality of the situation is that like the pandemic will end and people will ask me to do gigs that I don't really feel like doing, but it'll pay $150, so I'll do it. Like, you know, I'm still going to do that. I'm not going to pretend like I'm never going to do things like that again. But I definitely have thought a lot about like, why do I want to play music? What is it about music that I like and it feels important to me? And how do I want to reflect that through the music that I actually make? And a lot of that is related to what I mentioned a minute ago about like, you know, missing so badly, just being able to play with other people and kind of sharing that aspect of it. But yeah, I have a lot to kind of organize in my brain about those kinds of things, but definitely it's had me think.
Very cool. Well, how can we support you two as musicians? How can we support our work? Are there places where we can direct our listeners to?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. We each have recordings I have three albums that you can find if you search my name on Bandcamp. It's the best place to get them. But you can find them on Apple Music or Spotify if you just want to listen, even though I'm, what, like 0.004 cents per stream or something like that.
Yeah.
And Jesse, you have
an album. I have a brass trio album. It's me, horn, and a trombone player. Vento Brass Trio is the group, and we have an album out. So yeah, that'd probably be the best place to do that. Otherwise, just go out and see some live music once we're finally out of
and pay for it. $5 isn't very much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I have really enjoyed catching up and really talking through some of these issues that I don't think get brought up enough about music, the importance of music, what music does for our communities and our culture. So thank you so much for being with us. I'm really delighted to get a chance to.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having us.